The entire valley quivered as if to an earthquake tremor. Saul could vaguely hear the explosions continuing far to the south. But of more immediate concern now was the terrible glow from the Sphinx. Saul's shadow leaped 50 meters behind him down the stairway and across the valley floor as the tomb pulsed and vibrated with light. Out of the corner of his eye, Saul could see the other tombs glowing as brightly, huge Baroque reactors in their final seconds before meltdown. The entrance to the Sphinx pulsed blue, then violet, then a terrible white. Behind the Sphinx, on the wall of the plateau above the Valley of the Time Tombs, an impossible tree shimmered into existence, its huge trunk and sharp steel branches rising into the glowing clouds and above. Saul glanced quickly, saw the 3-meter thorns and the terrible fruit they bore, and then he looked back at the entrance to the Sphinx. Somewhere the wind howled and thunder rumbled. Somewhere vermilion dust blew like curtains of dried blood in the terrible light from the tombs. Somewhere voices cried out and a chorus shrieked. Saul ignored all this. He had eyes only for his daughter's face and, beyond her, for the shadow that now filled the glowing entrance to the tomb. The shrike emerged. The thing had to bend to allow its 3-meter bulk and steel blades to clear the top of the doorway. It stepped onto the top porch of the Sphinx and moved forward, part creature, part sculpture, walking with the terrible deliberation of nightmare. The dying light above rippled on the thing's carapace, cascaded down across curving breastplate to steel thorns there, shimmering on finger blades and scalpels rising from every point. Saul hugged Rachel to his chest and stared into the multifaceted red furnaces that passed for the shrike's eyes. The sunset faded into the blood-red glow of Saul's recurrent dream. The shrike's head turned slightly, swiveling without friction, rotating 90 degrees right, 90 degrees left, as if the creature were surveying its domain. The shrike took 3 steps forward, stopping less than 2 meters from Saul. The thing's 4 arms twisted and rose, finger blades uncurling. Saul hugged Rachel tightly to him. Her skin was moist, her face bruised and blotched with the exertions of birth. Seconds remained. Her eyes tracked separately, seemed to focus on Saul.
"Say yes, Daddy," Saul remembered the dream. The shrike's head lowered, until the ruby eyes in that terrible hood stared at nothing but Saul and his child. The quicksilver jaws parted slightly, showing layers and levels of steel teeth. 4 hands came forward, metallic palms up, pausing 0.5 meters from Saul's face.
"Say yes, Daddy."
Saul remembered the dream, remembered his daughter's hug, and realized that in the end, when all else is dust, loyalty to those we love is all we can carry with us to the grave. Faith, true faith, was trusting in that love. Saul lifted his newborn and dying child, seconds old, shrieking now with her first and last breath, and handed her to the shrike. The absence of her slight weight struck Saul with a terrible vertigo. The shrike lifted Rachel, stepped backward, and was enveloped in light. Behind the Sphinx, the tree of thorns ceased shimmering, shifted into phase with now, and came into terrible focus. Saul stepped forward, arms imploring, as the shrike stepped back into the radiance and was gone. Explosions rippled the clouds and slammed Saul to his knees with shock waves of pressure. Behind him, around him, the time tombs were opening.
Part 3. 31.
I awoke and was not pleased to be awakened. Rolling over, squinting and cursing the sudden invasion of light, I saw Lee Hunt sitting on the edge of the bed, an aerosol injector still in his hand.
"You took enough sleeping pills to keep you in bed all day," he said. "Rise and shine."
I sat up, rubbed the morning stubble on my cheeks, and squinted in Hunt's direction. "Who the hell gave you the right to enter my room?" The effort of speaking started me coughing, and I did not stop until Hunt returned from the bathroom with a glass of water.
"Here."
I drank, vainly trying to project anger and outrage between spasms of coughing. The remnants of dreams fled like morning mists. I felt a terrible sense of loss descend.
"Get dressed," said Hunt, standing. "The CEO wants you in her chamber in 20 minutes. While you've been sleeping, things have been happening."
"What things?" I rubbed my eyes and ran fingers through my tousled hair. Hunt smiled slightly.
"Access the datasphere. Then get down to Gladstone's chambers soonest. 20 minutes, Severn."
He left. I accessed the datasphere. One way to visualize one's entry point to the datasphere is to imagine a patch of old Earth's ocean in varying degrees of turbulence. Normal days tended to show a placid sea with interesting patterns of ripples. Crises showed chop and whitecaps. Today there was a hurricane underway. Entry was delayed to any access point. Confusion reigned in breaking waves of update surges. The datum plane matrix was wild with storage shifts and major credit transfers. And the all thing, normally a multi-layered buzz of information and political debate, was a raging wind of confusion, abandoned referenda, and obsolete position templates blowing by like tattered clouds.
"Dear God," I whispered,
breaking access but feeling the pressure of the information surge still pounding at my implant circuits and brain. War. Surprise attack, imminent destruction of the web, talk of impeaching Gladstone, riots on a score of worlds, Shrike cult uprisings on Lussis, the Force Fleet abandoning Hyperion system in a desperate rearguard action, but too late, too late. Hyperion already under attack, fear of Farcaster incursion. I rose, ran naked to the shower and sonicked in record time. Hunt or someone had laid out a formal gray suit and cape, and I dressed in a hurry, brushing back my wet hair so that damp curls fell to my collar. It wouldn't do to keep the CEO of the Hegemony of Man waiting. Oh no, that wouldn't do at all.
"It's about time you got here," said Maynard Gladstone as I entered her private chambers.
"What the fuck have you done?" I snapped. Gladstone blinked. Evidently, the CEO of the Hegemony of Man was not used to being spoken to in that tone. Tough shit, I thought.
"Remember who you are and to whom you're speaking," Gladstone said coldly.
"I don't know who I am, and I may be speaking to the greatest mass murderer since Horace Glennon Height. Why the hell did you allow this war to happen?"
Gladstone blinked again and looked around. We were alone. Her sitting room was long and pleasantly dark and hung with original art from old Earth. At that moment, I didn't care if I was in a room filled with original Van Goghs. I stared at Gladstone, the Lincoln-esque face merely that of an old woman in the thin light through the blinds. She returned my gaze for a moment, then looked away again.
"I apologize," I snapped, no apology in my voice.
"You didn't allow it. You made it happen, didn't you?"
"No, Severn. I did not make it happen." Gladstone's voice was hushed, almost a whisper.
"Speak up," I said. I paced back and forth near the tall windows, watching the light from the blinds move across me like painted stripes. "And I'm not Joseph Severn."
She raised an eyebrow. "Shall I call you M. Keats?"
"You can call me No Man," I said. "So that when the other Cyclopes come, you can say that no man has blinded you, and they will go away saying that it's the will of the gods."
"Do you plan to blind me?"
"Right now I could wring your neck and walk away without a twinge of remorse. Millions will die before this week is out. How could you have allowed it?"
Gladstone touched her lower lip. "The future branches only two directions," she said softly. "War and total uncertainty. Or peace and totally certain annihilation. I chose war."
"Who says this?"
There was more curiosity than anger in my voice now.
It is a fact. She glanced at her comm log. In 10 minutes I have to go before the Senate to declare war. Tell me the news of the Hyperion pilgrims. I crossed my arms and stared down at her. I will tell you if you promise to do something. I will if I can. I paused, realized that no amount of leverage in the universe could make this woman write a blank check on her word. All right, I said. I want you to flatline Hyperion, release the hold you have on the consul's ship, and send someone up the Hooghly River to find the consul himself. He's about 130 clicks from the capital, above the Carla locks. He may be hurt. Gladstone crooked a finger, rubbed her lip, and nodded. I will send someone to find him. Releasing the ship depends upon what else you have to tell me. Are the others alive? I curled my short cape around me and collapsed on a couch across from her. Some are. Byron Lamia's daughter, Braun. The shrike took her. For a while she was unconscious, connected to some sort of neural shunt to the datasphere. I dreamed she was floating somewhere, reunited with the implant persona of the first Keats retrieval personality. Just entering the datasphere. The megasphere, really. Core connections and dimensions I never dreamed of, as well as the accessible sphere. Is she alive now? Gladstone leaned forward, intense. I don't know. Her body disappeared. I was awakened before I saw where her persona entered the megasphere. Gladstone nodded. What about the Colonel? Cassad was taken somewhere by Moneta, the human female who seems to reside in the tombs as they travel through time. The last I saw of him, he was attacking the shrike barehanded. Shrikes, actually. There were thousands of them. Did he survive? I opened my hands. I don't know. These were dreams, fragments, bits and pieces of perception. The poet? Silenus was carried off by the shrike, impaled on the Tree of Thorns. But I glimpsed him there later in Cassad's dream. Silenus was still alive. I don't know how. So the Tree of Thorns is real. Not merely shrike cult propaganda. Oh yes, it's real. And the consul left, tried to return to the capital? He had his grandmother's hawking mat. It worked all right until he reached the place near Carla Locks I mentioned. It and he fell into the river. I preempted her next question. I don't know if he survived. And the priest, Father Hoyt? The cruciform brought him back as Father Duray. Is it Father Duray, or a mindless duplicate? It's Duray, I said, but damaged, discouraged. And he is still in the valley? No, he disappeared in one of the cave tombs. I don't know what happened to him. Gladstone glanced at her comm log. I tried to imagine the confusion and chaos which reigned in the rest of this building, this world, in the web. The CEO obviously had retreated here for 15 minutes prior to her speech to the Senate. It might be the last such solitude she would see for the next several weeks, perhaps ever. Captain Mastine. Dead. Buried in the valley. She took a breath. And Weintraub and the child. I shook my head. I dreamed things out of sequence, out of time. I think it's already happened, but I'm confused. I looked up. Gladstone was waiting patiently. The baby was only a few seconds old when the shrike came, I said. Saul offered her to the thing. I think it took her into the Sphinx. The tombs were glowing very brightly. There were other shrikes emerging. The tombs have opened then. Yes. Gladstone touched her comm log. Lee? Have the duty officer in the communications center contact Theo Lane and the necessary force people on Hyperion. Release the ship we have in quarantine. Also, Lee, tell the Governor General that I will have a personal message for him in a few minutes. The instrument chirped, and she looked back at me. Is there anything else from your dreams? Images, words. I don't understand what's going on. Those are the high points. Gladstone smiled slightly. Are you aware that you are dreaming events beyond the range of the other Keats persona's experience? I said nothing, stunned with the shock of what she said. My contact with the pilgrims had been possible through some core-based connection to the persona implant in Braun's Schroenloop.
through it and the primitive datasphere they had shared. But the persona had been liberated, the datasphere destroyed by separation and distance. Even a fatline receiver cannot receive messages when there is no transmitter. Gladstone's smile disappeared. Can you explain this?
No.
I looked up. Perhaps they were only dreams. Real dreams. She stood. Perhaps we'll know when and if we find the consul, or when his ship arrives in the valley. I have 2 minutes before I appear in the Senate. Is there anything else?
A question, I said. Who am I? Why am I here?
The slight smile again. We all ask those questions, M. Keats.
I'm serious. I think you know better than I.
The Corps sent you to be my liaison with the Pilgrims, and to observe. You are, after all, a poet and artist.
I made a noise and stood.
We walked slowly toward the private Farcaster portal that would take her to the Senate floor. What good does observation do when it's the end of the world?
Find out, said Gladstone. Go see the end of the world.
She handed me a micro card for my comm log. I inserted it, glanced at the disk key. It was a universal authorization chip, allowing me access to all portals, public, private, or military. It was a ticket to the end of the world.
I said, what if I get killed?
Then we will never hear the answers to your questions, said CEO Gladstone.
She touched my wrist fleetingly, turned her back, and stepped through the portal. For a few minutes I stood alone in her chambers, appreciating the light and silence and art. There was a Van Gogh on one of the walls, worth more than most planets could pay. It was a painting of the artist's room at Arles. Madness is not a new invention. After a while, I left, let my comlog memory guide me through the maze of Government House until I found the central Farcaster Terminex and stepped through to find the end of the world. There were 2 full-access Farcaster pathways through the web, the concourse and the river Tethys. I cast to the concourse where the half-kilometer strip of Tsingtao Siswang Pana connected to New Earth and the short seaside strip of Nevermore. Tsingtao Siswang Pana was a first-wave world, 34 hours away from the ouster onslaught. New Earth had been on the second-wave list, even now being announced, and had a little over a standard week before invasion. Nevermore was deep in the web, years away from attack. There were no signs of panic. People were taking to the datasphere and all thing rather than the streets, walking the narrow lanes of Tsingtao. I could hear Gladstone's voice from 1,000 receivers and personal comm logs, a strange verbal undertone to the shouts of street vendors and hiss of tires on wet pavement as electric rickshaws hummed overhead on the transport levels. As another leader told his people on the eve of attack almost 8 centuries ago, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. You ask, what is our policy? I say to you, it is to wage war in space, on land, in the air, by sea. Wage war with all our might and with all the strength justice and right can give us. That is our policy. There were 4 troops near the translation zone between Tsingtao and Nevermore, but the flow of pedestrians seemed normal enough. I wondered when the military would commandeer the pedestrian mall of the concourse for vehicular traffic, and if it would be headed toward the front or away. I stepped through to Nevermore. The streets were dry there, except for the occasional spray from the ocean 30 meters below the stone ramparts of the concourse. The sky was its usual tones of threatening ochre and gray, ominous twilight in the middle of the day. Small stone shops glowed with light and merchandise. I was aware that the streets were emptier than usual, people standing in shops or sitting on stone walls or benches, heads bowed and eyes distracted as they listened.
You ask, what is our aim? I answer in one word. It is victory.
victory at all costs, victory in spite of all terror, victory however long and hard the road may be. For without victory there is no survival.
The lines at Edgartown's main terminex were short. I coded for Mare Infinitus and stepped through. The skies were their usual cloudless green, the ocean beneath the float city a deeper green. Kelp farms floated to the horizon. The crowds this far from the concourse were even smaller. The boardwalks were almost empty, some shops closed. A group of men stood near a kipboat dock and listened to an antique fatline receiver. Gladstone's voice was flat and metallic in the sea-rich air. Even now, units of force move relentlessly to their stations, firm in their resolve and confident in their ability to rescue not only the threatened worlds, but all of the hegemony of man, from the foulest and most soul-destroying tyranny ever to stain the annals of history. Mare Infinitus was 18 hours from invasion. I looked skyward, half expecting to see some sign of the enemy swarm, some indication of orbital defenses, spaceborne troop movements. There was only the sky, the warm day, and the gentle rocking of the city on the sea. Heaven's Gate was the first world on the list of invasion. I stepped through the mud-flat VIP portal and looked down from Rifkin Heights at the beautiful city which belied its name. It was deep night. So late the mech street sweepers were out, their brushes and sonics humming against cobblestone. But here there was movement, long lines of silent people at the Rifkin Heights public terminex, and even longer lines visible below at the promenade portals. Local police were in evidence, tall figures in brown impact coveralls. But if force units were rushing to reinforce this area, they were invisible. The people in the lines were not local residents. The Rifkin Heights and promenade landowners almost certainly had private portals, but looked to be workers from the reclamation projects, many clicks out beyond the fern forest and parks. There was no panic and very little conversation. The lines filed past with the patient stoicism of families shuffling toward a theme park attraction. Few carried anything larger than a travel bag or backpack. Have we attained such equanimity, I wondered, that we handle ourselves with dignity even in the face of invasion? Heaven's Gate was 13 hours from H hour. I keyed my comm log to the all thing. If we can meet this threat, then worlds we love may remain free, and the life of the web may move forward into the sunlit future. But if we fail, then the whole web, the hegemony, everything we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made infinitely more sinister and protracted by the lights of science perverted and human freedom denied. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves that if the hegemony of man and its protectorate and allies were to last 10,000 years, humankind will still say, this was their finest hour. Somewhere in the silent, fresh-smelling city below, shooting began. First came the rattle of flechette guns, then the deep hum of anti-riot stunners, then screams and the sizzle of weapon lasers. The crowd on the promenade surged forward toward the terminex, but riot police emerged from the park, switched on powerful halogen searchlights which bathed the crowd in glare, and began ordering them through bullhorns to resume lines or disperse. The crowd hesitated, surged back and forth like a jellyfish caught in tricky currents, and then, spurred on by the sound of firing, louder and closer now, surged forward toward the portal platforms. The riot cops fired tear gas and vertigo canisters. Between the mob and the forecaster, violet interdiction fields whined into existence. A flight of military EMVs and security skimmers came in low over the city, searchlights stabbing downward. One of the beams of light caught me, held me until my comm log winked at an interrogation signal, and then moved on. It began to rain. So much for equanimity. The police had secured the Rifkin Heights public terminex and were stepping through the private atmospheric protectorate portal I had used. I decided to go elsewhere. There were force commandos guarding the halls of Government House, screening the Farcaster arrivals despite the fact that this portal was one of the most difficult to access in the web. I passed through 3 checkpoints before reaching the executive residential wing, where my apartments were. Suddenly, guards stepped out to empty the main hall and secure its tributaries, and Gladstone swept by accompanied by a swirling crowd of advisors, aides, and military leaders. Surprisingly, she saw me, brought her retinue to a clumsy halt, and spoke to me through the barricade of combat-armored Marines.
"How did you like the speech, M. No-Man?"
"Fine," I said. "Stirring. And stolen from Winston Churchill, if I'm not mistaken." Gladstone smiled and shrugged slightly.
"If one is to steal, steal from the forgotten masters." The smile faded.
"What is the news from the frontier?"
"The reality is just beginning to sink in," I said. "Expect panic."
"I always do," said the CEO.
"What news have you from the Pilgrims?"
I was surprised.
"The Pilgrims? I haven't been
dreaming." The current of Gladstone's retinue and impending events began to sweep her away down the hall.
"Perhaps you no longer need to sleep to dream," she called.
"Try it."
I watched her go, was released to seek out my suite, found the door, and turned away in disgust with myself. I was retreating in fear and shock from the terror descending on us all. I would be quite happy to lie in bed, avoiding sleep, the covers pulled tight to my chin, while I wept for the web, for the child Rachel, and for myself. I left the residential wing and found my way out to the central garden, wandering down graveled paths. Tiny micro-remotes buzzed like bees through the air, one pacing me as I passed through the rose garden, into the area where a sunken path twisted through steamy, tropical plants, and into the old earth section near the bridge. I sat on the stone bench where Gladstone and I had talked.
"Perhaps you no longer need to sleep to dream. Try it." I pulled my feet up on the bench, touched my chin to my knees, set fingertips against my temples, and closed my eyes.
32. Martin Silenus twists and writhes in the pure poetry of pain. A steel thorn 2 meters long enters his body between his shoulder blades and passes out through his chest, extending to a point a terrible, tapering meter beyond him. His flailing arms cannot touch the point. The thorn is frictionless. His sweaty palms and curling fingers can find no purchase there. Despite the thorn's slickness to the touch, his body does not slide. He is as firmly impaled as a butterfly pinned for exhibition. There is no blood. In the hours after rationality returned through the mad haze of pain, Martin Silenus wondered about that. There is no blood, but there is pain. Oh yes, there is pain in abundance here. Pain beyond the poet's wildest imaginings of what pain was. Pain beyond human endurance and the boundaries of suffering. But Silenus endures, and Silenus suffers. He screams for the 1,000th time, a ragged sound, empty of content, free of language, even obscenities. Words fail to convey such agony. Silenus screams and writhes. After a while, he hangs limply, the long thorn bouncing slightly in response to his gyrations. Other people hang above, below and behind him, but Silenus spends little time observing them. Each is separated by his or her own private cocoon of agony. "Why, this is hell," thinks Silenus, quoting Marlowe. "Nor am I out of it." But he knows it is not hell, nor any afterlife. But he also knows that it is not some sub-branch of reality. The thorn passes through his body, 8 centimeters of organic steel through his chest. But he has not died. He does not bleed. This place was somewhere and something, but it was not hell and it was not living. Time was strange here.
Silenus had known time to stretch and slow before. The agony of the exposed nerve in the dentist's chair. The kidney stone pain in the med clinic waiting room. Time could slow, seem not to move as the hands of an outraged biological clock stood still in shock. But time did move then. The root canal was finished. The Ultramore finally arrived, took effect. But here the very air is frozen in the absence of time. Pain is the curl and foam of a wave that does not break. Silenus screams in anger and pain and writhes upon his thorn. God damn, he manages at last. God damn, motherfuck, son of a bitch! The words are relics of a different life. Artifacts from the dream he had lived before the reality of the tree. Silenus only half remembers that life. As he only half remembers the shrike carrying him here, impaling him here, leaving him here. Oh, God! Screams the poet and clutches at the thorn with both hands, trying to lever himself up to relieve the great weight of his body, which adds so immeasurably to the unmeasurable pain. There is a landscape below. He can see for miles. It is a frozen, papier-mâché diorama of the Valley of the Time Tombs and the desert beyond. Even the dead city and the distant mountains are reproduced in plasticized, sterile miniature. It does not matter. For Martin Silenus, there is only the tree and the pain, and the two are indivisible. Silenus shows his teeth in a pain-cracked smile. When he was a child on old Earth, he and Amalfi Schwartz, his best friend, had visited a commune of Christians in the North American Preserve, learned their crude theology, and afterward had made many jokes about crucifixion. Young Martin had spread his arms wide, crossed his legs, lifted his head, and said, "Gee, I can see the whole town from up here!" Amalfi had roared. Silenus screams. Time does not truly pass. But after a while, Silenus's mind returns to something resembling linear observation, something other than the scattered oases of clear, pure agony, separated by the desert of mindlessly received agony. And in that linear perception of his own pain, Silenus begins to impose time on this timeless place. First, the obscenities add clarity to his pain. Shouting hurts, but his anger clears and clarifies. Then, in the exhausted times between shouting or pure spasms of pain, Silenus allows himself thought. At first, it is merely an effort to sequence, to recite the times tables in his mind, anything to separate the agony of 10 seconds ago from the agony yet to come. Silenus discovers that in the effort of concentrating, the agony is lessened slightly. Still unbearable, still driving all true thought like wisps before a wind, but lessened some indefinable amount. So Silenus concentrates. He screams and rails and writhes, but he concentrates. Since there is nothing else to concentrate on, he concentrates on the pain. Pain, he discovers, has a structure. It has a floor plan. It has designs more intricate than a chambered nautilus, features more baroque than the most buttressed Gothic cathedral. Even as he screams, Martin Silenus studies the structure of this pain. He realizes that it is a poem. Silenus arches his body and neck for the 10,000th time, seeking relief where no relief is possible. But this time he sees a familiar form 5 meters above him, hanging from a similar thorn, twisting in the unreal breeze of agony. "Billy!" gasps Martin Silenus, his first true thought. His former liege lord and patron stares across a sightless abyss, made blind with the pain that had blinded Silenus. But turning slightly, as if in response to the call of his name, in this place beyond names. "Billy!" cries Silenus again, and then loses vision and thought to the pain. He concentrates on the structure of pain, following its patterns as if he were tracing the trunk and branches and twigs and thorns of the tree itself.
My lord!
Silenus hears a voice above the screams, and is amazed to find that both the screams and the voice are his.
Thou art a dreaming thing, a fever of thyself. Think of the earth. What bliss, even in hope, is there for thee? What haven?
Every creature hath its home. Every soul man hath days of joy and pain, whether his labors be sublime or low. The pain alone, the joy alone, distinct. Only the dreamer venoms all his days, bearing more woe than all his sins deserve. He knows the verse, not his, John Keats's, and feels the words further structuring the seeming chaos of pain around him. Silenus understands that the pain has been with him since birth, the universe's gift to a poet. It is a physical reflection of the pain he has felt and futilely tried to set to verse, to pin down with prose all those useless years of life. It is worse than pain. It is unhappiness because the universe offers pain to all. Only the dreamer venoms all his days, bearing more woe than all his sins deserve. Silenus shouts it but does not scream. The roar of pain from the tree, more psychic than physical, abates for the barest fraction of a second. There is an island of distraction amidst this ocean of single-mindedness.
Martin!
Silenus arches, lifts his head, tried to focus through the haze of pain. Sad King Billy is looking at him. Looking. Sad King Billy croaks a syllable which, after an endless moment, Silenus recognizes as,
More.
Silenus screams in agony, writhes in a palsied spasm of mindless physical response. But when he stops, dangling in exhaustion, the pain not lessened, but driven from the motor areas of his brain by fatigue toxins, he allows the voice within him to shout and whisper its song.
Spirit here that reignest, spirit here that painest, spirit here that burnest, spirit here that mournest, spirit, I bow my forehead low, and shaded with thy pinions. Spirit, I look all passion struck into thy pale dominions.
The small circle of silence widens to include several nearby branches. A handful of thorns carrying their clusters of human beings in extremis. Silenus stares up at sad King Billy and sees his betrayed lord open his sad eyes. For the first time in more than 2 centuries, patron and poet look upon one another. Silenus delivers the message that has brought him here, hung him here.
My lord, I'm sorry.
Before Billy can respond, before the chorus of screaming drowns out any response, the air changes, the sense of frozen time stirs, and the tree shakes, as if the entire thing has dropped a meter. Silenus screams with the others as the branch shakes and the impaling thorn tears at his insides, rends his flesh anew. Silenus opens his eyes and sees that the sky is real. The desert reel, the tombs glowing, the wind blowing, and time begun again. There is no lessening of torment, but clarity has returned. Martin Silenus laughs through tears.
Look, Mom!
He shouts, giggling, the steel spear still protruding a meter beyond his shattered chest.
I can see the whole town from up here!
M. Severn, are you all right?
Panting, on my hands and knees, I turned toward the voice. Opening my eyes was painful, but no pain could compare to what I had just experienced.
Are you all right, sir?
No one was near me in the garden. The voice came from a micro-remote that buzzed half a meter from my face, probably one of the security people somewhere in Government House. Yes, I managed, getting to my feet and brushing gravel from my knees. I'm fine. A sudden
pain. Medical help can be there in 2 minutes, sir. Your biomonitor reports no organic difficulty, but we can't... No, no, I said. I'm fine. Leave it be. And leave me alone. The remote fluttered like a nervous hummingbird. Yes, sir. Just call if you need anything. The garden and grounds monitor will respond. Go away, I said. I went out of the gardens, through the main hall of Government House, all checkpoints and security guards now, and out across the landscaped acres of Deer Park. The dock area was quiet, the river Tethys more still than I had ever seen it. "What's happening?" I asked one of the security people on the pier. The guard accessed my comm log, confirmed my executive override PIP and CEO clearance, but still did not hurry to answer.
"The portals have been turned off for TC squared," he drawled. "Bypassed."
"Bypassed? You mean the river doesn't flow through Tau Ceti Center anymore?"
"Right."
He flipped his visor down as a small boat approached, flipped it up when he identified the two security people in it. "Can I get out that way?" I pointed upriver to where the tall portals showed an opaque curtain of gray. The guard shrugged.
"Yeah. But you won't be allowed back that way."
"That's all right. Can I take that small boat?" The guard whispered into his bead mic and nodded.
"Go ahead."
I stepped gingerly into the small craft, sat on the rear bench and held onto the gunnels until the rocking subsided, touched the power disk key and said, "Start." The electric jets hummed, the small launch untied itself and pointed its nose into the river, and I pointed the way upstream. I had never heard of part of River Tethys being cordoned off, but the Farcaster curtain was now definitely a one-way and semi-permeable membrane. The boat hummed through, and I shrugged off the tingling sensation and looked around. I was in one of the great canal cities, Aardman or Pomolo, perhaps, on Renaissance Vector. The Tethys here was a main street from which many tributaries flowed. Ordinarily, the only river traffic here would be the tourist gondolas on the outer lanes and the yachts and go-everywheres of the very rich in the pass-through center lanes. Today, it was a madhouse. Boats of every size and description clogged the center channels, boats headed in both directions. Houseboats were piled high with belongings. Smaller craft were so heavily laden that it looked like the smallest wave or wake would capsize them. Hundreds of ornamental junks from Tsingtao Siswang Pana and Million Mark River condo barges from Fuji vied for their share of the river. I guess that few of these residential boats had ever left their tie-ups before. Amidst the riot of wood and plasteel and perspex, go-everywheres moved by like silver eggs, their containment fields set to full reflection. I queried the datasphere. Renaissance Vector was a second-wave world, 107 hours from invasion. I thought it odd that Fuji refugees were crowding the waterways here, since that world had more than 200 hours until the axe fell. But then I realized that except for the removal of TC squared from the waterway, the river still flowed through its usual series of worlds. Refugees from Fuji had taken the river from Tsingtao, 33 hours from the ousters, through Dinebdre at 147 hours, through Renaissance Vector toward Parsimony or Grass, both unthreatened at this time. I shook my head, found a relatively sane tributary street from which to watch the madness, and wondered when the authorities would reroute the river so that all threatened worlds flowed to sanctuary. Can they do that, I wondered? The Technocorps had installed River Tethys as a gift to the hegemony during its pentacentennial. But surely Gladstone or someone had thought to ask the Corps to aid in the evacuation. Had they? I wondered. Would the Corps help? I knew that Gladstone was convinced that elements of the Corps were intent upon eliminating the human species. This war had been her Hobson's choice given that alternative. What a simple way for the anti-human Corps elements to carry out their program, merely refuse to evacuate the billions threatened by the ousters. I had been smiling, however grimly. But that smile faded as I realized that the Technocorps also maintained and controlled the Farcaster grid that I depended on to get out of the threatened territories.
I had tied up the launch at the base of a stone stairway that descended into the brackish waters. I noticed green moss growing on the lowest stones. The stone steps themselves? Possibly brought from old Earth, since some of the classical cities were shipped via Farcaster in the early years after the big mistake, were worn with age, and I could see a fine tracery of cracks connecting sparkling flecks there, looking like a schematic of the world web. It was very warm, and the air was too thick, too heavy. Renaissance Vector's sun hung low above the gabled towers. The light was too red and too syrupy for my eyes. Noise from the Tethys was deafening even here, 100 meters down the equivalent of an alley. Pigeons whirled in agitation between dark walls and overhanging eaves. What can I do? Everyone seemed to be acting as the world slouched toward destruction, and the best I could do was wander aimlessly. That's your job. You're an observer. I rubbed my eyes. Who said that poets had to be observers? I thought of Li Po and George Wu leading their armies through China and writing some of the most sensitive verse in history while their soldiers slept. And at least Martin Silenus had led a long, eventful life, even if half the events were obscene and the other half wasted. At the thought of Martin Silenus, I groaned aloud. Is the child, Rachel, hanging from that tree of thorns even now? For a second I pondered that, wondering if such a fate were preferable to the quick extinction of Merlin's sickness. No. I closed my eyes, concentrated on thinking of nothing at all, hoping that I could make some contact with Saul, discover something about the fate of the child. The small boat rocked gently from distant wakes. Somewhere above me, the pigeons fluttered to a ledge and cooed to one another.
"I don't care how difficult it is," shouts Mena Gladstone. "I want all of the fleet in Vega system to defend Heaven's Gate, then shift the necessary elements to God's Grove and the other threatened worlds. The only advantage we have right now is mobility."
Admiral Singh's face is dark with frustration.
"Too dangerous, M-Executive. If we move the fleet directly to Vega space, it runs a terrible risk of being cut off there. They will certainly attempt to destroy the singularity sphere that connects that system to the web."
"Protect it," snaps Gladstone. "That's what all the expensive warships are for."
Singh looks to Morpurgo or the other brass for help. No one speaks. The group is in the executive complex war room. The walls are heavy with hollows and flowing columns of data. No one is watching the wall.
"It is taking all our resources to protect the singularity sphere in Hyperion space," says Admiral Singh, his voice low, words carefully spaced. "Retreating under fire, especially under the onslaught of the entire swarm there, is very difficult. Should that sphere be destroyed, our fleet would be 18 months time debt from the web. The war would be lost before they could return."
Gladstone nods tersely.
"I'm not asking you to risk that singularity sphere until all elements of the fleet have translated, Admiral. I've already agreed to let them have Hyperion before we get all our ships out. But I insist that we do not surrender worlds of the web without a fight."
General Morpurgo stands. The Lusian looks exhausted already.
"CEO, we're planning a fight. But it makes much more sense to begin our defense at Hebron or Renaissance Vector. Not only do we gain almost 5 days to prepare our defenses, but..."
"But we lose 9 worlds, interrupts Gladstone. "Billions of hegemony citizens, human beings. Heaven's Gate would be a terrible loss, but God's Grove is a cultural and ecological treasure, irreplaceable."
"CEO, says Alan Emoto, Minister of Defense. "There is evidence coming in that the Templars have been in collusion with the so-called Church of the Shrike for many years. Much of the funding for Shrike cult programs has come from..."
Gladstone flicks her hand to silence the man.
"I don't care about that. The thought of losing God's Grove is untenable. If we can't defend Vega and Heaven's Gate, we draw the line at the Templar planet. That's final."
Singh looks as if he has been weighted with invisible chains as he attempts an ironic smile.
That gains us less than an hour, CEO.
It's final, repeats Gladstone.
Lee, what's the status of the riots on Lucis?
Hunt clears his throat. His demeanor is as hangdog and unhurried as ever.
M executive. At least 5 hives are now involved. Hundreds of millions of marks in property have been destroyed. 4 ground troops have been translated from Freeholm and appear to have contained the worst of the looting and demonstrations. But there is no estimate of when Farcaster service can be restored to those hives. There is no doubt that the Church of the Shrike is responsible. The initial riot in Bergstrom Hive began with a demonstration of cult fanatics, and the bishop broke into HTV programming until he was cut off by...
Gladstone lowers her head.
So he's finally surfaced. Is he on Lucis now?
We don't know, M executive, replies Hunt. Transit Authority people are trying to trace him and his top acolytes.
Gladstone swivels toward a young man I do not recognize for a moment. It is Commander William Ahunta Lee, the hero of the Battle for Maui Covenant. When last heard of, the young man had been transferred to the Outback for daring to speak his mind in front of his superiors. Now the epaulets of his 4C uniform carry the gold and emerald of a rear admiral's insignia.
What about fighting for each world? Gladstone asks him, ignoring her own edict that the decision was final.
I believe it's a mistake, CEO, says Lee. All 9 swarms are committed to the attack. The only one we won't have to worry about for 3 years, assuming we can extricate our forces, is the swarm now attacking Hyperion. If we concentrate our fleet, even half our fleet, to meet the menace to God's Grove, the odds are almost 100% that we will not be able to shift those forces to defend the 8 other first wave worlds.
Gladstone rubs her lower lip.
What do you recommend?
Rear Admiral Lee takes a breath.
I recommend we cut our losses, blow the singularity spheres in those 9 systems, and prepare to attack the second wave swarms before they reach inhabited star systems.
Commotion erupts around the table. Senator Feldstein from Barnard's world is on her feet, shouting something. Gladstone waits for the storm to subside.
Carry the fight to them, you mean? Counterattack the swarms themselves, not wait to fight a defensive battle?
Yes, M. Executive.
Gladstone points at Admiral Singh.
Can it be done? Can we plan, prepare, and launch such offensive strikes by...
She consults the data stream on the wall above her.
94 standard hours from now.
Singh pulls himself to attention.
Possible? Perhaps, CEO. But the political repercussions of losing 9 worlds from the web, the logistical difficulties of...
But it's possible, presses Gladstone.
Yes, M executive, but if... Do it! Says Gladstone.
She rises, and the others at the table hurry to get to their feet.
Senator Feldstein, I'll see you and the other affected legislators in my chambers. Lee, Allen, please keep me informed on the Lucis riots. The War Council will readjourn here in 4 hours. Good day, gentlemen and ladies.
I walked the streets as in a daze, my mind tuned to echoes. Away from River Tethys, where canals were fewer and the pedestrian thoroughfares were wider, the crowds filled the avenues. I let my comlog lead me to different terminexes, but each time the throngs were thicker there. It took me a few minutes to realize that these were not merely inhabitants of Renaissance 5 seeking to get out, but sightseers from throughout the web shoving to get in. I wondered if anyone on Gladstone's evacuation task force had considered the problem of millions of the curious casting in to see the war begin. I had no idea how I was dreaming conversations in Gladstone's war room, but I also had no doubt they were real. Thinking back now, I remembered details of my dreams during the long night past, not merely dreams of Hyperion,
but the CEO's world walk and details from high-level conferences. Who was I? A cybrid was a biological remote, an appendage of the AI, or in this case, of an AI retrieval persona, safely ensconced somewhere in the core. It made sense that the core knew everything that went on in Government House, in the many halls of human leadership. Humanity had become as blasé about sharing their lives with potential AI monitoring as pre-Civil War old Earth USA Southern families had been about speaking in front of their human slaves. Nothing could be done about it. Every human above the lowest dregs hive property class had a comm log with biomonitor. Many had implants, and each of these was tuned to the music of the datasphere, monitored by elements of the datasphere, dependent upon functions of the datasphere. So humans accepted their lack of privacy. An artist on Esperance had once said to me, "Having sex or a domestic quarrel with the house monitors on is like undressing in front of a dog or cat. It gives you pause the first time, and then you forget about it." So was I tapping into some back channel known just to the core? There was a simple way to find out. Leave my cybrid and travel the highways of the megasphere to the core, the way Braun and my disembodied counterpart had been doing the last time I had shared their perceptions. No. The thought of that made me dizzy, almost ill. I found a bench and sat a moment, lowering my head between my knees and taking long, slow breaths. The crowds moved by. Somewhere, someone was addressing them through a bullhorn. I was hungry. It had been at least 24 hours since I'd eaten, and cybrid or no, my body was weak and famished. I pressed into a side street where vendors shouted above the normal din, hawking their wares from one-wheeled gyro carts. I found a cart where the line was short, ordered fried dough with honey, a cup of rich Bressian coffee, and a pocket of pita bread with salad. Paid the woman with a touch of my universal card and climbed a stairway to an abandoned building to sit on the balcony and eat. It tasted wonderful. I was sipping my coffee, considering going back for more fried dough, when I noticed that the crowd in the square below had ceased its mindless surges and had coalesced around a small group of men standing on the rim of a broad fountain in the center. Their amplified words drifted to me over the heads of the crowd.
"The angel of retribution has been loosed among us. Prophecies fulfilled, the millennium come, the plan of the Avatar calls for such sacrifice, as prophesied by the Church of the Final Atonement, which knew, which has always known, that such atonement must be made. Too late for such half-measures, too late for internecine strife. The end of mankind is upon us, the tribulations have begun, the millennium of the Lord is about to dawn."
I realized that the men in red were priests of the Shrike cult, and that the crowd was responding, first with scattered shouts of agreement, occasional cries of yes, yes, and amen, and then with chanting in unison, raising fists surging above the crowd, and fierce cries of ecstasy. It was incongruous, to say the least. The web in this century had many of the religious overtones of the Rome of old Earth just before the Christian era. A policy of tolerance, a myriad of religions, most, like Zen Gnosticism, complex and inwardly turned, rather than the stuff of proselytism. While the general tenor was one of gentle cynicism and indifference to religious impulse. But not now. Not in this square. I was thinking about how free of mobs recent centuries had been. To create a mob there must be public meetings. And public meetings in our time consisted of individuals communing via the All Thing or other datasphere channels. It is hard to create mob passion when people are separated by kilometers and light years, connected only by comm lines and fat line threads. Suddenly, I was jarred from my reveries by a hush in the crowd's roar, a turning of 1,000 faces in my direction.
"And there is one of them!"
cried the Shrike cult holy man, his red robes flashing as he pointed in my direction.
"One of those from the sealed circles of the hegemony. one of the scheming sinners who has brought the atonement to us this day. It is that man and those like him who want the Shrike Avatar to make you pay for his sins while he and the others hide in safety in the secret worlds the hegemony leadership has set aside for just this day. I put down my cup of coffee, gulped my last bit of fried